In Tuesday's arguments about the Affordable Care Act, Justice Anthony Kennedy began the questioning by asking Solicitor General Donald Verrilli about the scope of Congress's power under the Commerce Clause. In response, General Verrilli clarified the government's position.
Can you create commerce in order to regulate it?
That's not what's going on here, Justice Kennedy, and we're not seeking to defend the law on that basis. In this case, what is being regulated is the method of financing the purchase of health care. That itself is economic activity with substantial effects on interstate commerce.
Chief Justice Roberts probed whether the fact that everybody uses health care really makes it as different as the government says.
Police, fire, ambulance, roadside assistance, whatever. You don't know when you're going to need it. You're not sure that you will. But the same is true for health care. You don't know if you're going to need a heart transplant or if you ever will. So there's a market there. In some extent, we all participate in it. So can the government require you to buy a cell phone because that would facilitate responding when you need emergency services? You can just dial 911 no matter where you are?
No, Mr. Chief Justice, I think that's different. I don't think we think of that as a market. This is a market. This is market regulation. And in addition, you have a situation in this market not only where people enter involuntarily as to when they enter and won't be able to control what they need, what they enter.
But it seems to me that's the same as in my hypothetical. You don't know when you're going to need police assistance. You can't predict the extent to emergency response that you'll need. But when you do, and the government provides it, I thought that was an important part of your argument, that when you need health care, the government will make sure you get it. Well, when you need police assistance or fire assistance or ambulance assistance, the government is going to make sure, to the best extent it can, that you get it.
I think the fundamental difference, Mr. Chief Justice, is that that's not an issue of market regulation. This is an issue of market regulation, and that's how Congress looked at this problem. There is a market. Insurance is provided through a market system.
Justice Alito followed up by pointing out another market that everybody has to use and asking whether Congress could compel the purchase of those services as well.
All right, suppose that you and I walked around downtown Washington at lunch hour and we found a couple of healthy young people and we stopped them and we said, you know what you're doing? You are financing your burial services right now because eventually you're going to die and somebody's going to have to pay for it. And if you don't have burial insurance or you haven't saved money for it, you're going to shift the cost to somebody else. Isn't that a very artificial way of talking about what somebody is doing?
You know,
and if that's true, why isn't it equally artificial to say that somebody who's doing absolutely nothing about health care is financing health care services?
Justice Kennedy thought the statute might be special in a different way, and he raised the issue of how it interacts with individual liberties.
Assume for the moment that this is unprecedented. This is a step beyond what our cases have allowed, the affirmative duty to act to go into commerce. If that is so, do you not have a heavy burden of justification? I understand that we must presume laws are constitutional. But even so, when you are changing the relation of the individual to the government in this, what we can stipulate is, I think, a unique way, do you not have a heavy burden of justification to show authorization under the Constitution?
General Verrilli had been describing the individual mandate as a means to regulate health care. Justice Scalia took issue with the idea that health care was the relevant market.
Sure. Why do you define the market that broadly? Health care. It may well be that everybody needs health care sooner or later, but not everybody needs a heart transplant. Not everybody needs a liver transplant.
That's correct, Justice Scalia, but you never know whether you're going to
Could you
that
define
person.
The market? Everybody has to buy food sooner or later, so you define the market as food. Therefore, everybody's in the market. Therefore, you can make people buy broccoli.
No, it's quite different. It's quite different. The food market, while it shares that trait that everybody's in it, it is not a market in which your participation is often unpredictable and often involuntary. It is not a market in which you often don't know before you go in what you need, and it is not a market in which if you go in and seek to obtain a product or service, you will get it even if you...
Is that a principled basis for distinguishing this from other situations? I mean, you know, you could also say, well, the person subject to this has blue eyes. That would indeed distinguish it from other situations. Is it a principled basis? It's a basis that explains why the government is doing this. But is it a basis which shows that this is not going beyond what the system of enumerated powers allows the government to do?
Throughout the argument, justices expressed concern that the government's position did not have an obvious limiting principle. Justice Kennedy asked the Solicitor General to make it explicit.
Can you identify for us some limits on the Commerce Clause?
Yes. The rationale purely under the Commerce Clause that we're advocating here would not justify forced purchases of commodities for the purpose of stimulating demand. It would not justify purchases of insurance for the purposes in situations in which insurance doesn't serve as the method of payment.
But why not? If Congress says that interstate commerce is affected, isn't, according to your view, that the end of the analysis?
No. We think that the difference between those situations and this situation is that in those situations, Your Honor, Congress would be moving to create commerce. Here, Congress is regulating existing commerce, economic activity that is already going on, people's participation in the healthcare market.
The General did get a few friendly questions as well. Justice Ginsburg chimed in to note that cost shifting was a major justification for the Affordable Care Act.
I thought a major, major point of your argument was that the people who don't participate in this market are making it much more expensive for the people who do. That is, they will get, a goodly number of them will get services that they can't afford at the point when they need them, and the result is that everybody else's premiums get raised. So you're not, it's not your free choice just to do something for yourself. What you do is going to affect others, affect them in a major way.
However, most of the questions were considerably more probing. Justice Scalia asked whether it was wrong to view the act through the lens of the health care market as opposed to the health insurance market.
I don't agree with you that the relevant market here is health care. You're not regulating health care. You're regulating insurance. It's the insurance market that you're addressing, and you're saying that some people who are not in it must be in it. And that's different from regulating in any manner commerce that already exists out there.
Well, to the extent that we're looking at the comprehensive scheme, Justice Scalia, it is regulating commerce that already exists out there. And the means in which that regulation is made effective here, the minimum coverage provision, is a regulation of the way in which people participate, the method of their payment in the healthcare market.
Justice Kennedy returned to the theme he had articulated earlier, that by requiring people to engage in commerce, the Affordable Care Act imposed an unprecedented burden on individual liberty.
The reason this is concerning is because it requires the individual to do an affirmative act. And here the government is saying that the federal government has a duty to tell the individual citizen that it must act, and that is different from what we have in previous cases.
Well,
that changes the relationship of the federal government to the individual in a very fundamental way.
Chief Justice Roberts expressed concern that people were being forced to buy policies that they would not actually inevitably use.
It's critical how you define the market. If I understand the law, the policies that you're requiring people to purchase must contain provision for maternity and newborn care, pediatric services, and substance use treatment. It seems to me that you cannot say that everybody is going to need substance use treatment. substance use treatment or pediatric services, and yet that is part of what you require them to purchase.
Well, it's part of what the statute requires the insurers to offer, and I think the reason is because it's trying to define minimum essential coverage because...
Yeah, but your theory is that there is a market in which everyone participates because everybody might need a certain range of health care services. And yet you're requiring people who are never going to need pediatric or maternity services to participate in that market.
With respect to what insurance has to cover, Your Honor, I think Congress is entitled to latitude in making the judgments of what the appropriate scope of coverage is. And the problem here in this market is that you may think you're perfectly healthy and you may think that you're not, that you're being forced to subsidize somebody else. But this is not a market in which you can say that there is an immutable class of healthy people.
General Verrilli explained that the individual mandate was necessary to implement the Affordable Care Act's ban on discrimination against individuals with pre-existing conditions. However, some justices expressed skepticism about that explanation.
You could solve that problem by simply not requiring the insurance company to sell it to somebody who has a condition that is going to require medical treatment, or at least not require them to sell it to him at a rate that he sells it to healthy people. But you don't want to do that.
But that seems to me to say, Justice Scalia, that Congress, that's the problem here.
Yes, and it's a self-created problem.
Congress cannot solve the problem through standard economic regulation, and I do not think that can be the premise of our understanding of the
Congress's economic regulation produces, whatever they are,
I think
Congress can do something to counteract them. Requiring somebody to enter the insurance market.
It's not a problem of Congress's creation. The problem is that you have 40 million people who cannot get affordable insurance through the means that the rest of us get affordable insurance. Congress, after long study and careful deliberation and viewing the experiences of the states and the way they tried to handle this problem, adopted a package of reforms, guaranteed issue and community rating and subsidies and the minimum coverage provision are a package of reforms that solve that problem. I think it's highly artificial to view this as a problem of Congress's own creation.
It wasn't long before the conversation turned back to the government's proposed limiting principle. Justice Alito asked the general to describe it as succinctly as possible.
Before you move on, could you express your limiting principle as succinctly as you possibly can? Congress can force people to purchase a product where the failure to purchase the product has a substantial effect on interstate commerce if what? If this is part of a larger regulatory scheme?
We've got two, and they're different. Let me state them. First, with respect to the comprehensive scheme, when Congress is regulating, is enacting a comprehensive scheme that it has the authority to enact, that the Necessary and Proper Clause gives it the authority to include regulation, including a regulation of this kind, if it is necessary to counteract risks attributable to the scheme itself, that people engage in economic activity that would undercut the scheme. It's very much like Wickard in that respect, very much like Raich in that respect. Considering the Commerce Clause alone and not embedded in the comprehensive scheme, our position is that Congress can regulate the method of payment by imposing an insurance requirement in advance of the time in which the service is consumed, when the class to which that requirement applies either is or virtually will certain to be in that market, when the timing of one's entry into that market and what you will need when you enter that market is uncertain, and when you will get the care in that market, whether you can afford to pay for it or not, and shift costs to other market participants. So those are our views. Those are the principles we're advocating for, and it's, in fact, the conjunction of the two of them here that makes this, we think, a strong case under the Commerce Clause.
The first hour of argument closed with a brief discussion about whether Congress could enact the individual mandate under its taxing power. Justice Ginsburg asked whether taxes must always be revenue-raising measures.
Taxes to raise revenue. Tax is a revenue-raising device. And the purpose of this exaction is to get people into the health care risk pool before they need medical care. And so it will be successful if it doesn't raise any revenue, if it gets people to buy the insurance. That's what this penalty is. This penalty is designed to affect conduct. The conduct is buy health protection, buy health insurance before you have a need for medical care. That's what the penalty is designed to do, not to raise revenue.
That is true, Justice Ginsburg. That is also true of the marijuana tax that was upheld in Sanchez. That's commonly true of penalties under the code. They do, if they raise revenue, they are exercises of the taxing power. But their purpose is not to raise revenue. Their purpose is to discourage behavior. The mortgage deduction works that way. When the mortgage deduction is, it's clearly an exercise of the taxing power. When it's successful, it raises less revenue for the federal government. It's still an exercise of the taxing power.
Justice Kagan followed up by asking whether the inquiry should focus on how Congress labeled the law or instead on its practical effects.
I suppose, though, General, one question is whether the determined efforts of Congress not to refer to this as a tax make a difference. I mean, you're suggesting we should just look to the practical operation, we shouldn't look at labels, and that seems right, except that here we have a case in which Congress determinedly said this is not a tax, and the question is why should that be irrelevant?
I don't think that that's a fair characterization of the actions of Congress here, Justice Kagan. On the December 23rd, a point of constitutional order was called to, in fact, with respect to this law. The floor sponsor, Senator Baucus, defended it as an exercise of the taxing power. In his response to the point of order, the Senate voted 60-39 on that proposition. The legislative history is replete with members of Congress explaining that this law is constitutional as an exercise of the taxing power. It was attacked as a tax by its opponents. So I don't think this is a situation where you can say that Congress was avoiding any mention of the tax power. It would be one thing if Congress explicitly disavowed an exercise of the tax power, but given that it hasn't done so, it seems to me that it's not only is it fair to read this as an exercise of the tax power, but this Court has got an obligation to construe it as an exercise of the tax power.
Justice Scalia rounded out the first hour of argument by asking whether the taxing power provided a sufficient independent basis to uphold the Act, even if it was not constitutional as an exercise of the commerce power.
You're saying that all the discussion we had earlier about how this is a one big uniform scheme and the Commerce Clause, blah, 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 it really doesn't matter. This is a tax. And the federal government could simply have said, without all of the rest of this legislation, could simply have said, everybody who doesn't buy health insurance at a certain age will be taxed so much money, right?
It used its powers together to solve the problem of the market not providing
affordable coverage. Yeah, but you didn't need that. You didn't need that. If it's a tax, it's only raising money is enough.
It is justifiable under its tax power.
At the start of the second hour, Paul Clement took the podium and summarized the challenger's position.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, the mandate represents an unprecedented effort by Congress to compel individuals to enter commerce in order to better regulate commerce. The Commerce Clause gives Congress the power to regulate existing commerce. It does not give Congress the far greater power to compel people to enter commerce, to create commerce essentially in the first place.
Justice Sotomayor began the questioning by asking whether Congress could require everybody who uses health care services to pay with insurance.
Do you accept the General's position that you have conceded that Congress could say if you're going to consume health services, you have to pay by way of insurance?
That's right, Justice Sotomayor. We say, consistent with 220 years of this Court's jurisprudence, that if you regulate the point of sale, you regulate commerce, that's within Congress's
And Justice Kagan had the follow-up question.
Well, it seems as though you're just talking about a matter of timing, that Congress can regulate the transaction, and the question is, when does it make best sense to regulate that transaction? And Congress surely has it within its authority to decide, rather than at the point of sale, given an insurance-based mechanism, it makes sense to regulate it earlier. It's just a matter of timing.
Clement responded that insurance does more than simply pay for health care services in advance. It also forces some people to subsidize other people. Justice Ginsburg wasn't sure that that was a problem.
Let me put it this way. Congress in the 30s saw a real problem of people needing to have old age and survivor's insurance. And yes, they did it through a tax, but they said everybody's got to be in it, because if we don't have the healthy in it, there's not going to be the money to pay for the ones who become old or disabled or widowed. So they required everyone to contribute. There was a big fuss about that in the beginning, because a lot of people said, maybe some people still do today, I could do much better if the government left me alone. I'd go into the private market, I'd buy an annuity, I'd make a great investment, and they're forcing me to pay for this Social Security that I don't want. But that's constitutional. So if Congress could see this as a problem, when we need to have a group that will subsidize the ones who are going to get the benefits, it seems to me you're saying the only way that could be done is if the government does it itself. It can't involve the private market. It can't involve the private insurers. If it wants to do this, Social Security is its model. Government has to do – has to be a government takeover. We can't have the insurance industry in it. Is that –
Justice Sotomayor also saw similarities between the mandate and tax policies.
Could we have an exemption? Could the government say everybody pays a share health care responsibility payment to offset all the money that we're forced to spend on health care, we the government? But anybody who has an insurance policy is exempt from that tax. Could the government do that?
The government might be able to do that. I think it might raise some issues about whether or not that would be a valid exercise of the taxing power.
And under what theory wouldn't it be?
Well, I do think that
we get tax credits for having solar-powered homes. We get tax credits for using fuel-efficient cars. Why couldn't we get a tax credit for having health insurance and saving the government from caring for us?
In response to the frequent suggestion that by forcing people to act, the mandate is somehow different from other laws, Justice Breyer offered several examples of where Congress requires people to act.
Can't Congress make people drive faster than 40 miles an hour on a road? Didn't they make that man in growing his own wheat go out into the market and buy other wheat for his cows? Didn't they make if she married somebody who had marijuana in her basement, wouldn't she have to go and get rid of it? Affirmative action? I mean, where does this distinction come from? It sounds like sometimes you can and sometimes you can't.
Clement distinguished those hypotheticals, arguing that all of them discussed regulation of existing commerce and not a requirement to get involved in new commerce. The Chief Justice responded.
Well, Mr. Clement, the key to the government's argument to the contrary is that everybody is in this market. It's all right to regulate Wickard against Filburn, because that's a particular market in which the farmer had been participating. Everybody is in this market, so that makes it very different than the market for cars or the other hypotheticals that you came up with. And all they're regulating is how you pay for it.
When Clement responded that not everybody is currently in the market for health insurance, and that, in fact, that's the problem Congress is trying to solve, Justice Kagan followed up.
Well, doesn't that seem a little bit, Mr. Clement, cutting the baloney thin? I mean, health insurance exists only for the purpose of financing health care. The two are inextricably interlinked. We don't get insurance so that we can stare at our insurance certificate. We get it so that we can go and access health care.
Well, Justice Kagan, I'm not sure that's right. I think what health insurance does, and what all insurance does, is it allows you to diversify risk. And so it's not just a matter of I'm paying now instead of paying later. That's credit. Insurance is different than credit.
Justice Kennedy pressed the point, asking whether the fact that people must be accounted for by insurers, even if they do not purchase health insurance, means that they are effectively in the market.
But they're in the market in the sense that they're creating a risk that the market must account for.
Well, Justice Kennedy, I don't think that's right, certainly in any way that distinguishes this from any other context. When I'm sitting in my house deciding I'm not going to buy a car, I am causing the labor market in Detroit to go south. I am causing maybe somebody to lose their job and for everybody to have to pay for it under welfare. So the cost shifting that the government tries to uniquely associate with this market, it's everywhere. And even more to the point, the rationale that they think ultimately supports this legislation, that, look, it's an economic decision. Once you make the economic decision, we aggregate the decision. There's your substantial effect on commerce. That argument works here. It works in every single industry.
The second lawyer for the challengers, Michael Carvin, took the podium and explained that, in his view, the crucial reason why the Affordable Care Act's mandate is unconstitutional is because Congress has decided to promote a new form of commerce instead of regulating existing commerce. But the Chief Justice wasn't fully persuaded.
Surely regulation includes the power to promote. So since the New Deal, we've said there's regulation in there's a market in agricultural products. Congress has the power to subsidize, to limit production, all sorts of things.
Absolutely, Chief Justice, and that's the distinction I'm trying to draw. When they're acting within their enumerated power, then obviously they're promoting commerce. But the Solicitor General wants to turn it into a different power. He wants to say we have the power to promote commerce, to regulate anything to promote commerce. And if they have the power to promote commerce, then they have the power to regulate everything, right?
I don't think you're addressing their main point, which is that they're not creating commerce in health care. It's already there, and we're all going to need some kind of health care, most of us will, at some point.
Justice Breyer posed a severe hypothetical, which generated a surprising response.
And if it turned out there was some terrible epidemic sweeping the United States, and we couldn't say that more than 40 or 50%, I can make the number as high as I want, but you'd say the federal government doesn't have the power to get people inoculated, to require them to be inoculated, because that's just statistical.
Well, in all candor, I think Morrison must have decided that issue, right? Because people who commit violence...
Is your answer to that yes or no?
Oh, I'm sorry. My answer is no, they couldn't do it because...
No, they could not do it. They cannot require people, even if this disease is sweeping the country, to be inoculated.
After Carvin responded to Breyer's hypothetical, Justice Alito took his own turn.
Well, Mr. Carvin, isn't there this difference between Justice Breyer's hypothetical and the law that we have before us here? In his hypothetical, the harm to other people from the communicable disease is the result of the disease. It is not the result of something that the government has done. Whereas here, the reason why there's cost shifting is because the government has mandated that. It has required hospitals to provide emergency treatment, and instead of paying for that through a tax, which would be borne by everybody, it has required the it has set up a system in which the cost is surreptitiously shifted to people who have health insurance and who pay their bills when they go to the hospital.
But others weren't sure that cost shifting was a feature of Congress's policies. Some justices seemed to regard it as inevitable, and the question for them was whether Congress could act to mitigate its adverse effects on the rest of the population.
I suggested, Mr. Carvin, that it might be different if you were raising an as-applied challenge and presenting a class of people whom you could say clearly would not be in the health care market. But you're raising a facial challenge, and we can't really know which of the many, many people that this law addresses in fact will not participate in the health care market and in fact will not impose costs on all the rest of us. So the question is, can Congress respond to those facts that we have no crystal ball, that we can't tell who is and isn't going to be in the health insurance market, and say most of these people will be, and most of these people will thereby impose costs on the rest of us And that's a problem that we can deal with on a class-wide basis.
No, again, the people who impose the cost on the rest of us are people who engage in a different activity at a different time, which is defaulting on their health care payments. It's not the uninsured. Under your theory, you could regulate anybody if they've got a statistical connection to a problem. You could say, since we could regulate people who enter into the mortgage market and impose mortgage insurance on them, we can simply impose the requirement to buy private mortgage insurance on everybody before they've entered the market, because we're doing it in this prophylactic way before it develops. And
I don't think that's fair, because not everybody is going to enter the mortgage market. Well, the government's position is that almost everybody is going to enter the healthcare market.
At the conclusion of the challenger's argument, Justice Sotomayor returned to the theme that she had raised earlier, that the mandate shares many features with existing tax incentive programs.
I want to understand the choices you're saying Congress has. Congress can tax everybody and set up a public health care system.
Yeah.
That would be okay.
Yeah. Tax power is on.
Okay. Congress can, or are you taking the same position as your colleague? Congress can't say, we're going to set up a public health system, but you can get a tax credit if you have private health insurance because you won't access the public system. Are you taking the same position?
There may have been confusion in your prior colloquy. I fully agree with my brother Clement that a direct tax would be unconstitutional. I don't think he means to suggest, nor do I, that a tax credit that incentivizes you to buy insurance creates a problem. Congress incentivizes all kinds of activities. If they gave us a tax credit for buying insurance, then it would be our choice whether or not that makes economic sense.
So how's that different than this act, which says if a taxpayer fails to meet the requirement of having minimum coverage, then they are responsible for paying the shared responsibility payment?
The difference is that the taxpayer is not given a choice. It's the difference between banning cigarettes and saying, I'm going to enforce that legal ban through a $5 a pack penalty, and saying, look, if you want to sell cigarettes, fine, I'm going to charge you a tax of $5 a pack. And
I think that's what's happening, isn't it?
No,
I thought that everybody was paying, what is it, $10 a pack now? I don't even know the price. Pretty high.
Right.
Everybody recognizes that it's all taxation for the purposes of dissuading you to buy it.
That's precisely my point. And everyone intuitively understands that that system is dramatically different than saying cigarettes tomorrow are illegal.
General Verrilli had 4 minutes of uninterrupted rebuttal time. He began by summarizing his side's position on the Commerce Clause and explaining why the alternatives posed by the other side would not solve the problem that Congress had identified.
Congress confronted a grave problem when it enacted the Affordable Care Act. The 40 million Americans who can't get health insurance and suffer often very terrible consequences. Now, we agree, I think, everyone arguing this case agrees, that Congress could remedy that problem by imposing an insurance requirement at the point of sale. That won't work. The reason it won't work is because people will still show up at the hospital or at their physician's office seeking care without insurance, causing the cost-shifting problem. And Mr. Clement's suggestion that they can be signed up for a high-risk pool at that point is utterly unrealistic. Think about how much it would cost to get the insurance when you are at the hospital or at the doctor. It would be unfathomably high. That will never work. Congress understood that. It chose the means that will work, the means that it saw worked in the states and in the state of Massachusetts, and that it had every reason to think would work on a national basis.
The argument concluded with Verrilli arguing in the alternative that the court should uphold the mandate as a legitimate exercise of Congress's taxing power, and indeed that the court had an obligation to do so.
But if there's any doubt about that under the Commerce Clause, then I urge this court to uphold the minimum coverage provision as an exercise of the taxing power. Under New York against the United States, this is precisely a parallel situation. If the court thinks there's any doubt about the ability of Congress to impose the requirement in 5000A sub A, it can be treated as simply the predicate to which the tax incentive of 5000A sub B seeks accomplishment. And the court, as the court said in New York, has a solemn obligation to respect the judgments of the democratically accountable branches of government. And because this statute can be construed in a manner that allows it to be upheld in that way, I respectfully submit that it is this court's duty to do so.